And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
This is Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Icon has every odd Thursday of the month.
First and third.
First and third, no fifth. An event at our gallery that we call Odd Thursday, and on that night we have various interesting discussions and presentations. And coming up on October 18th, Alan Cobb, who is a sound artist and general 21st century Renaissance man, will be presenting a presentation on sound as substance. Well, say a few words about this. We got him
right here. Yeah, this is, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I started thinking about what I would say to a room full of people about sound, and I thought, gosh, I don't even know where to start. I have so much interesting stuff, at least I think it's interesting to say. And so I started writing it down, and I found myself writing for about 3 hours, and when I got done, I had this piece of, you know, essay kind of thing that was rather terse and would probably take about 2 hours just to read it briskly from beginning to end. So I thought, okay, that's a little bit much for an Odd Thursday, where usually the presentation is about 30 minutes and then we talk about it. So I've been boiling it down and breaking it up into sections. I'm actually going to do a two-part presentation. The first part is sound as substance. And then a few weeks later, I think the next Odd Thursday is October 1st.
November 1st.
And that one is going to be called Hearing Space. And there's a lot more material to do, but what really turned out to be fun in planning this thing is realizing how many sound examples and demonstrations and things I could actually put together. So I'm not completely sure what you're going to get on this coming Odd Thursday. Which I guess is next week. There will be lots of little recordings, demonstrations, things that will surprise you about how the sense of hearing works and about what sound is. And also, in looking into this, I've learned a bit about the neurophysiology of the sense of hearing, and in some related areas, the neurophysiology of the sense of sight. And it's very surprising. We don't hear the sonic vibrations that hit the ear. We hear something else. And in a similar way, we don't see the light that enters the eyeball. We see something very, very different. And it's because there's so much incredibly intelligent processing going on in the brain and in the nervous system, connections between the brain and the actual mechanical senses. So it's very exciting. It really kind of reveals perhaps what you might call the gross level of Maya. You know, it shows how our experience is fabricated and it's constructed and it's massaged and polished and presented to the awareness in a nice, smooth, coherent, utterly convincing form, but what's actually going on is so different from that that it's almost ridiculous. Most people aren't aware of the fact, and almost no one is subjectively aware of the fact, that we are blind, absolutely, totally blind, for approximately maybe as much as an eighth of a second every second. In fact, we think that in a movie, you see a series of images flashed on the screen and the brain melds them together. But in reality, what we see is continuous, analog, wrong. It's not. It's not continuous. The eye doesn't see anything continuous. What the eye sees is a sequence of still pictures. And it moves microscopically in between those still pictures, and while it's moving, the image is blurred. And this preprocessor that takes care of the signal before we see it, subjectively, this preprocessor says, oh, that's blurred, so they shut it off. And they fill in that time gap with whatever the previous image was. And I find that just really kind of startling. I thought that I was seeing continuous motion, and when I went to the movies, I saw a simulation of the real world. But in fact, what I see when I see the real world is also just like a movie. It's a sequence of still pictures. So that's, you know, and there are sound analogies to that, and I don't want to try and do the sound presentation right now. But there are a lot of surprising experiences to be had with relationship with respect to how we actually hear things.
Well, this whole thing you were just talking about with regard to hearing and seeing, it conjured up a question in my mind about the relationship of the two senses, or probably all the five senses, because to me there are certain sounds that themselves as sounds are very visual. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's even to such a degree that there'll be sometimes if my eyes are closed and there's some loud bang outside or some kind of a series of taps or something like that, it'll almost appear inside my eyes as like a bunch of little triangles or something like that. You know, there seems to be some actual pattern to it. But the other thing I was talking about is certain kinds of sounds will bring back possibly a memory or just have a flavor of some dark street or, you know, a forest or the ocean, even though the sound isn't related to those things at all. There's something about that sound that conjures up that image. So do you, have you studied any of that sort of
thing? Well, yeah, I as I've mentioned in some previous programs, I tend to divide sound into four broad categories. One is music, one is speech, one is what I call referential sound, and that's where you hear the sound of a car door slamming, and you instantly know what it is. You could almost see a car door slamming in your mind's eye when you hear that sound, or a dog barking, or this a bottle dropping to the pavement or something. And so those are sounds that have definitions, and they're sounds that are really patterns with a beginning and an end that we have isolated from the sea of sound that they occur in. And that isolation is a special kind of thing. It's a pattern recognition process that we do with everything, all sensory input. And so the fourth category is the one that I've been trying to explore with my art, and that's everything else. Sounds that are not speech, not music, and not recognizably the sound effect of something. And it's a fascinating phenomenon. For example, on this Odd Thursday presentation, I'm going to play a recording that people will hear and they will not be able to recognize it at all. Then I will say something which is words that actually correspond to the sound you just heard. Then when I play the sound again, you will hear it as garbled speech. And you won't be able to not hear it as garbled speech from that point on. And what this illustrates is that the speech processing center in the brain, or wherever it lives, I'm assuming it mostly lives in the brain, that speech processing a part of the brain, isn't on all the time. It gets turned on by some invisible preprocessor that listens to the signal before we hear it subjectively and says, there's no speech in that, and so we don't need to turn on all that extra equipment. And then once it has heard that there is speech that corresponds to that, then when it hears it the second time, it turns on the speech processing center, and you hear it as speech. And it's just an amazing phenomenon, and there's all sorts of examples of that. The first part of what you mentioned correlates to a phenomenon that's called synesthesia, where people, you know, see or people experience through the wrong sense or experience something through an additional sense, so that sometimes people can hear color or see a sound, as you were describing. And that's, you know, that may partly be related to just associations, but sometimes there are some crossovers in the neural pathways, and there are neurological conditions that are, you know, well documented because they happen often enough, where people really do see sounds. I mean, they can't help it. They see color, and the color corresponds to what they're hearing, and it's consistent. And when they hear complicated sounds, they see the appropriate combinations of complicated colors.
Well, would two people see the same colors with under
it,
the same?
It doesn't look like that's the way it works. It looks like people with synesthesia have a, you know, sort of an arbitrary cross connection between the two senses, and it doesn't seem to work, you know, in a predictable way between multiple people. I could be wrong. I mean, it's a whole branch of neurology. But when you start looking into neurology, there's just so many amazing things that happen when a person's brain isn't operating completely correctly. The things that that can go wrong defy the imagination. And I would like to highly recommend to our listening audience, anyone who has not read any of the books by Oliver Sacks, by all means go out and get pretty much any one of them. He's most famous for his first big seller, which was called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And it's about a man with some, you know, brain damage from tumor surgery or something. He's a professor of music at a university, and he has had no impairment of his musical skills whatsoever. But when his wife puts a plate of food in front of him on the dinner table, she has to wave the smell of the food into his face, because when he sees that plate of food, he doesn't recognize it as a plate of food. But when he smells it, he knows, and then he can pick up his fork, and he can still see it perfectly well. He just can't recognize it. He can walk from his home to his office, but he can't walk back. He gets lost. And they figured out that, if I'm remembering it correctly from the book, they figured out that there were certain landmarks that he was seeing with one eye. And because of what had happened in his brain, when he saw them predominantly on the other side of his body, he couldn't recognize them. But when they were on the other side of his body, he could recognize them.
So what's the part about his wife and the hat?
Oliver Sacks suggested that they go for a walk. And the man was sitting on the couch next to his wife. And he said, "Yes, let me just put on my hat." And he reached over and put his hand on his wife's head, and then appeared to be very puzzled because he couldn't pick it up. He thought his wife's head was his hat, and it was too heavy. It wasn't responding the way a hat should. So it's just, you know, the mind is one thing. The brain and the physiology that supports the conscious mind is another thing. And there are layers and layers of phenomenally subtle and sophisticated and creative processing going on that we're just totally unaware of.
Yeah, in every single part of our body. I mean, that is like astonishing. And I used to read anatomy books for fun when I was younger, and mainly just for the kind of thing that you've just been talking about, because any anatomy book, even straightforward ones that aren't trying to be sensationalistic or anything, and they're just telling you how your liver works or something like that, it's filled with such a wonderland that you just can't believe that all of these things are not only going on in your body, but are working properly most of the time.
And that's totally automatic. You have nothing at all to do with it.
Yeah, exactly.
You can mess it up, but you can't help. You can't really do anything about it. No, it's very, very amazing. And when you think about this from a, you know, kind of a cosmic or metaphysical standpoint, it really means that in a very concrete way, the notion that the world is not as it appears to be is really very correct. It's not at all the way it appears to be. And understanding the mechanics of how we perceive it, it gives us insight into the machinery. But what it really also does is it shows us that the world that we are perceiving is so different from what we're perceiving that our whole universe of understanding of how things are is really just our imagination. It's just a wonderfully consistent shared illusion that we do with the rest of the people in the world.
So anybody who says I have no imagination is completely off base.
The whole thing, everything you experience is at least 50% imagination.
So I have a question that's a little off the subject of your sound presentation, but because you've studied sound so extensively, you might know about this. We treasure the ability to hear and use all of our senses, but commonly as people age, their ability to hear diminishes. Mm-hmm. What causes, is that something that actually has to do with the mechanism inside the ear or with the brain?
You know? No, it's mostly mechanical. The physiology of hearing is spectacularly delicate. You know, we hear this concept of infinity from a point. And in the case of hearing, that's exactly what it is. The three bones that connect the eardrum to the actual nerve structures that do the hearing, they're called the ossicles, and they're in common language, they're known as the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup. And the stirrup, our stapes, is the smallest bone in the human body. And it's connected to the anvil by a little nodule that fits into a little socket in the end of the anvil, which is another section of bone that has some musculature on it, which allows the ear to tense those muscles and make the ear less sensitive so loud sounds don't rip everything apart. But that little joint between the anvil and the stirrup, that little nodule is about the one-third the diameter of a human hair.
Wow.
Depending on which human's hair you're talking about, but you know it's really really tiny, and everything that we hear is transmitted through that point. Then it goes into essentially, it goes into the cochlea, which is called that just because it's coiled up like a seashell kind of. But the cochlea is lined with little hair cells, little hairs called cilia, and each cilium is responsible for picking up on a different frequency, for detecting a different frequency. So the spectrum of sound frequencies is distributed along the length of the cochlea, and those little hairs are very, very sensitive. The cochlea is full of fluid, so the vibration transmitted through the fluid, you know, wiggles all the hairs, and certain hairs say, ah, A440, or whatever, you know, pitch they're supposed to be tuned to. When you get into the high frequency sound doesn't move very much distance. Low frequency sounds are big. They're a sound wave of a timpani or something is bigger than the room that we're in right now. But the high-frequency sound waves are very, very fine, and the actual movement of the cilium is really small. It turns out it is so small that the displacement of the tip of the cilium, let's use an example. Imagine the Sears Tower in Chicago, and if you wiggled the Sears Tower so that at the very top of the tower it moved a couple of inches. That's how much movement it takes in one of these cilia at a very, very tiny scale. On the scale of the cilium, that amount of movement is less than the diameter of the nucleus of a carbon atom. In fact, some say it's the amount of movement necessary to hear that sound is less than the diameter of a proton. So we're talking about a physical structure that we use for hearing stuff that's sensitive to mechanisms, to mechanics on the scale of quantum physics. It's actually a quantum scale detector.
Wow.
And a similar thing is true of sight. You can see one photon. If you emit one photon into the eye, and you have to do it statistically because of the nature of photons, they can be seen. So Here we've got two sensors that are capable of perceiving quantum phenomena on a macroscopic scale, and they're the outside of the nervous system. Presumably, it's a lot more sensitive and subtle inside than it is on the outer surface where the sensors are. So that gives you an idea just how subtle what's going on inside actually is.
So when a person begins to lose their ability to hear clearly, is it the cilia?
Becoming less sensitive. The fluid in the cochlea may be, you know, becoming a little less fluid. Mm. There are lots of you know, little things that begin to deteriorate, and it's the same in vision. Mm-hmm. The main thing that people notice with age-related hearing changes is a loss of extreme high-frequency response. The most delicate of the detectors mm-hmm. don't work as well. And also less adaptivity to changes in loudness. Which is why older people will be telling younger people to turn it down. Mm. Because their ears, the older ears, aren't as able to accommodate sudden changes in loudness. Mm. And the youthful ear doesn't have any problem with it, so they're thinking, it's not that loud, what's the big deal? And the old person is thinking, God, it's distorting. I can hear my ear distorting. It's obviously way too loud, and you know, those kids don't know what they're hearing. But we're really having two different experiences. And I don't think there's much that you can do about it. One would hope that there's some sort of dietary regimen would be good for the ears. You know, eating carrots is supposed to be good for your eyes. But I don't know that that's been borne out by any research.
Yeah, wasn't that just because rabbits ate a lot of carrots and they have good eyesight?
They seem to have good eyesight. Yeah,
like that.
I think birds of prey have much better eyesight.
Yeah, really.
And they don't eat vegetables at all.
So I'm sorry, it took you way off into a different track from your presentation, but it was just so interesting.
Well, it's all connected, as far as I'm concerned.
And I think we should do another show where we address the other.
Sure.
Can we get a second show in before or during?
Yeah, yes, we can, before the Odd Thursday.
Yeah, right. Next week, so the show will be the day before the Odd Thursday.
I don't know if we can do it now, a little synopsis of the sound as substance, and then the name of the second show was?
Yeah, the second show, which will be November 1st, Thursday evening at ICON, is hearing space.
See, what I want to do is a little definition of those two terms, so we can do it now. Yeah.
Sound as we've got 4 minutes
segue
left.
Into the next one.
Sound as substance. Really, one of the things I want to get across to people is that the way we hear, we think of hearing a sound, but in fact, we don't hear a sound and then another sound. We're in a sea of sound. We're in a continuum of sound that starts sometime before we're born and continues until we don't have a nervous system anymore. And that sound field is incredibly complex, and it's just unfathomably complex. The number of different vibrations bouncing around this room and bumping into your eardrum is uncountable and unfathomably complicated, even in this simple, quiet room with only a couple of people talking and an air conditioning system in the background. So what we do when we hear a sound is we actually pick out a pattern from that continuum of stuff, and that pattern has a beginning and an end. In fact, the simplest definition of a pattern is something that has a beginning and an end. If it doesn't have a beginning and an end, you can't possibly perceive it as a thing. And so I want to go into that and show how sound really is kind of an ocean that we're immersed in. And then how do we pick out the things that we are aware of from this continuous ocean of infinitely varying vibration. And I should say one other thing. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the term vibration. We talk about electromagnetic radiation, electromagnetic vibration, and we talk about sound vibration. These are very different things.
And good vibrations.
And good vibrations. absolutely. and sound is basically pressure waves in some medium. The sound as that we hear typically is pressure waves in the air that we're in. And if you have two spacemen in spacesuits making sounds inside their spacesuits, there is absolutely nothing that goes from one spacesuit to the other. You can vibrate, you can yell at your faceplate and vibrate that glass as much as you like. There's nothing between it and the other spacesuit, and so nothing is transmitted. So sound requires a physical medium. You can hear sound through the floor, or you can put your hand on a violin while someone's playing it and feel the vibrations. But what you're hearing is vibrating pressure waves in the air. So there's we don't want to confuse those vibrations with the vibrations of electromagnetic fields and things like that. It's not quite as profound as that. And then a quick word about sound, about hearing space, which is the second part. Hearing space is really a thing that I've been thinking about a lot over the last 7 or 8 years. It seems that sound and the way we perceive it may in fact be the origin of our sense of being in a volumetric universe, of being in a three-dimensional space. Yes, we can see it, but it looks to me like that notion of three-dimensionality really comes more out of the sense of hearing. And part of the reason for saying that is that hearing itself comes out of the sense of touch. Hearing is a brilliant elaboration of the sense of touch. And it's the sense of touch that really determines the notion of space. The fact that you can stretch your arm out and know that it's farther away from your head than it was before you stretched it out. That's kinesthesia. And that tells us that space exists.
Before we end, I just wanted to make sure that the listening audience knows we have been listening to Alan Cobb, who is going to be giving a presentation on Odd Thursday at Icon Gallery, October 18th at 8 p.m. And we'll be demonstrating all these things he's been talking about today.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.